From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
From the Supreme Court to the science community now, there's consensus on the reality that carbon dioxide, the bubbles in beer, actually have global consequences for humans and the environment.
The Supreme Court rules the EPA can regulate greenhouse gases as we look at the growing climate divide between rich and poor countries. We'll speak with the environmental reporter for the New York Times, Andrew Refkin. Then nearly 400 civilians have been killed in fierce fighting in Somalia.
Somalia is more violent now than it was in the last 15 years. And this is so because of the U.S. intervention, which has ruined the peace that the Islamic courts had brought to the country.
We'll speak with columnist Salim Loni. From global warming to global warming. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Supreme Court has ruled the Environmental Protection Agency has the authority under the Clean Air Act to regulate the emission of greenhouse gases linked to global warming. The ruling is seen as a major victory for the environmental movement. Until now, the Bush administration has refused to view carbon dioxide as an air pollutant subject to EPA regulation. In a 5-4 decision, the court ruled the EPA violated the Clean Air Act by improperly declining to regulate new vehicle emission standards to control the pollutants that scientists say contribute to global warming. The Natural Resources Defense Council said ruling, quote, repudiates the Bush administration's do-nothing policy on global warming. Frank O'Donnell of Clean Air Watch said, quote, this means California and other states have the clear right to limit greenhouse gas emissions if the Bush administration won't. In a separate decision, the Supreme Court declined to hear an appeal from detainees at Guantanamo challenging the legality of the Military Commissions Act of 2006. The law strips detainees of the right to habeas corpus. The Pentagon announced Monday it is sending another 9,000 U.S. troops to Iraq. About half the soldiers are returning to combat duty ahead of schedule, less than a year after they left Iraq. Meanwhile, in the northern Iraqi city of Kirkuk, 15 people died in a suicide truck bombing Monday. The dead include 9 children and a U.S. soldier. Nearly 200 people were injured in the blast. A new study has revealed suicide bombings against civilians in Iraq have increased dramatically since the start of the year and are deadlier than ever. The Gulf Research Center found 92 confirmed suicide attacks against civilian targets in February and March, compared with 62 in the last 2 months of 2006. The first 3 months of 2007 have also been a particularly deadly period for reporters in Iraq. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, 18 Iraqi journalists have died so far this year. Back in this country, Senator Barack Obama has admitted Congress will likely continue to fund the war in Iraq, even if President Bush vetoes the supplemental spending bill that sets a timeline for the withdrawal of troops. In an interview with the Associated Press, Obama said, quote, I think nobody wants to play chicken with our troops on the ground. Meanwhile, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has endorsed a bill written by Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin that would cut off funding of the war within a year. The bill sets a deadline of next March 31st for completing the withdrawal of combat forces and ending most military spending in Iraq. The Independent of London has revealed the recent standoff between Iran and Britain over the captured British sailors may have its roots in a botched U.S. military raid in Iraq. According to the paper, the U.S. military attempted to abduct 2 senior Iranian security officials in northern Iraq on January 11th. The officials have been identified as Mohammad Jafari, the powerful deputy head of the Iranian National Security Council, and General Manohar Farzandeh, the chief of intelligence of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. The men were in Iraq on official business to meet with the Iraqi president. The U.S. failed to seize the 2 officials, but they did capture 5 relatively junior Iranian officials. The U.S. has been holding the 5 Iranians since January 11th at an undisclosed location. On Monday, U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called on Iran to release the 15 British sailors.
As a Secretary General, I would again hope that we will be able to see some early release of this UK sailors. I know that there are many issues involved, but it would be desirable for the international community to see early resolve on this issue in a diplomatic and peaceful way. Yeah.
Meanwhile, the Bush administration announced on Monday a former FBI agent has been missing in Iran for several weeks. The U.S. claims the man was in Iran on private business. His name has not been released. In other news from the Middle East, the McClatchy newspapers are reporting the Bush administration has launched a campaign to isolate and embarrass Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Some officials fear the campaign is aimed at destabilizing Syria. In recent weeks, the State Department has issued a series of rhetorical broadsides against Syria. One official said, quote, "It's the new Cuba. No language is too tough." The U.S. is also covertly funding election monitors inside and outside Syria of the April 22nd parliamentary elections. In Somalia, nearly 400 people have been killed since Thursday in what's been described as the worst fighting in the capital of Mogadishu in 15 years. Most of the fighting has been between U.S.-backed Ethiopian troops and Somali fighters allied to the Somali Council of Islamic Courts. The UN is estimating more than 47,000 people have fled Mogadishu since March 21st. We'll have more on Somalia after headlines. In Zimbabwe, labor leaders have launched a two-day general strike to protest the country's economic crisis. Zimbabwe's employment rate has reached about 80%, and the country has the world's highest rate of inflation. Meanwhile, the opposition leader, Morgan Tsvangirai, said on Monday he's ready to negotiate with Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe without any preconditions. Tsvangirai spoke in Johannesburg, where he's receiving medical care after being beaten by Zimbabwean police. Tsvangirai called for free and fair elections next year, but questioned if that's possible.
How do you go into an election when the opposition is being battered? How do you go in an election when there is freedom, no freedom of assembly, freedom of expression, the media is banned? How do you go in an election when the very same machinery of running an election is militarized?
President Mugabe's government has accused Morgan Tsvangirai and other opposition leaders of plotting to violently overthrow the government. In media news, the Tribune Company has a new owner, Chicago real estate billionaire Sam Zell. The Tribune Company publishes the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, the Baltimore Sun, and other newspapers. It also owns several TV stations and the Chicago Cubs baseball team. In other media news, a growing number of national Latino organizations are calling on PBS to make changes to an upcoming film by Ken Burns about World War II because it ignores the role played by Latino soldiers in the war. The 14-hour documentary reportedly includes no interviews with any Latino veterans. Over 500,000 Latinos served in World War II. In Texas, state officials have decided to release a 15-year-old girl who was serving a 7-year prison sentence for shoving a teacher's aide in her school hallway. Shaquanda Cotton was released Sunday after spending a year in prison. Her release came after weeks of protests over her sentence. Supporters say Shaquanda was unfairly punished because she's African-American and because of her mother's previous involvement in a group that fought discrimination against black students. Shaquanda, who had no prior criminal record, was convicted on one count of assaulting a public servant last year. The teacher's aide was not injured, and the incident's details are in dispute. The judge in the case, Chuck Superville of Lamar County, has been accused of double standards after he sentenced a 14-year-old girl, a white girl, to probation. The head of the state's juvenile prison system has also announced plans to review the sentences of all 4,700 juveniles in state custody. The white girl had set fire to her home. Chicago's police superintendent, Philip Klein, has unexpectedly resigned amidst a series of scandals involving police misconduct. Last week, a Chicago police officer named Anthony Abate was arrested for beating a female bartender. The beating was captured on video. It shows the 250-pound off-duty police officer pummeling the 115-pound bartender. The beating took place on February 19th, but police waited over a month to make an arrest. In business news, the subprime mortgage lending company New Century Financial has filed for bankruptcy and plans to lay off 3,200 employees. Nearly 50 mortgage lenders have now filed for bankruptcy protection or closed since the end of last year. New Century is the largest company to do so. Tomorrow on Democracy Now!, we'll speak with Danny Schechter about the subprime mortgage issue. And we'll also link on our website to my colleague Juan Gonzalez, co-host on Democracy Now!'s articles on this issue. U.S. and South Korean trade negotiators have signed a new trade deal. It's the largest U.S. free trade agreement since NAFTA was signed over a decade ago. This is Karen Bhatia, U.S. Deputy Trade Representative.
The free trade agreement we are announcing today is a historic accomplishment. By breaking down barriers to trade and investment, it will benefit the industrious and creative people of both of our countries, create new economic opportunities, and strengthen a vital economic and strategic partnership that goes back half a century.
Outside the trade talks, South Korean protesters rallied against the free trade deal. One man set himself on fire and shouted, "Stop the Korea-U.S. FTA." Farmers in South Korea have opposed the deal because they fear it'll lead to an inflow of cheap U.S. agricultural imports. The trade deal must still be approved by lawmakers in Washington and Seoul. And the city of Seattle has agreed to pay $1 million to protesters arrested during the World Trade Organization demonstration 7 years ago. The money will be split by 160 protesters who were arrested in the city's Westlake Park on December 1, 1999. In addition, Seattle agreed to seal the arrest records of the protesters. Attorney Tyler Weaver said, quote, "I'm hopeful this case will send a message not only to the city of Seattle, but to cities around the country that mass arrests of peaceful, law-abiding protesters will not and cannot be tolerated." Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Supreme Court has ruled the Environmental Protection Agency has the authority to regulate the emission of greenhouse gases linked to global warming. In a 5-4 decision, the court ruled the EPA violated the Clean Air Act by improperly declining to regulate new vehicle emission standards to control the pollutants that scientists say contribute to global warming. It's the first high court decision in a case involving global warming and is seen as a defeat for the Bush administration, which has refused to view carbon dioxide as an air pollutant subject to EPA regulation. The ruling comes as a new report from the world's leading group of climate change experts is set for release this Friday. The UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is expected to underline that while global warming is changing physical and biological systems on every continent, Western countries must take extra steps to address the growing climate divide. Poor countries have borne the brunt of environmental problems from the release of carbon dioxide by the U.S. and Western Europe, but have been left almost entirely on their own to deal with the consequences. This means that while Western countries spend billions on dealing with the effects of climate change, those most in need receive little funding to deal with far greater catastrophe. On Monday, panel chair Rajendra Pachauri called on Western countries to address the disparity.
What we're really talking about is as much an ethical issue as an issue that sort of concerns the stability of global society. In the Framework Convention on Climate Change, it's clearly specified that resources will be provided by the developed countries to the developing world, and that transfer of technology in particular will be facilitated by the developed countries. So I think it's there in the agreement, but it's a question of implementing it both in letter and spirit. And there, may I say, enough has not happened.
Rajendra Pachauri, who chairs the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. European Environment Commissioner Stavros Dimas also talked about the U.S. role as the world's leading emitter of greenhouse gases.
It's obvious that the importance of the United States is paramount because they are emitting about one-fourth of the world's emissions of greenhouse gases. And also they have a very high per capita income. And they have contributed historically to the creation of the greenhouse phenomenon more than any other region of the world, with exception of the European Union countries. So they have a duty to come along in an international agreement after 2012.
For more on the latest, I'm joined now by Andrew Refkin. He's an award-winning science reporter for the New York Times, author of several books. His latest is called The North Pole Was Here, Puzzles and Perils at the Top of the World. In today's New York Times, Andrew Refkin writes, quote, "A growing array of officials in developing countries and experts on climate, environmental law and diplomacy insists the first world owes the third world a climate debt." Andrew joins us from a studio in Watertown, Massachusetts. Welcome to Democracy Now, Andrew.
It's good to be here.
Before we talk about the global climate divide between rich and poor countries, let's go to this U.S. Supreme Court decision that has rocked the Bush administration. Can you talk about its significance?
Well, there was only one time that George Bush, as far as I know, ever described carbon dioxide, the main greenhouse gas, as a pollutant. That was when he was running for president. He pledged to limit emissions of this gas, along with other stuff, from power plants. But then right after he got elected, he backpedaled away from that campaign pledge. And then from that point onward, for the administration, the idea that carbon dioxide might be a pollutant, like lead or sulfur dioxide, the stuff that we're more familiar with as harmful substances, harmful substances kind of went away. It was a bright line in the sand, and anything that looked like it would move in that direction, they fought really, really hard. And now the Supreme Court has kind of just sort of taken away that whole presumption that there's some reason not to look at carbon dioxide as a hazard when it's in excess amounts, which is this whole question, how much carbon dioxide is too much. It has gone away. The Supreme Court has essentially said the EPA can't just sort of say we're not going to examine that question, particularly in this case, because the EPA contended two things. They said the science isn't there, that there's risk, and they also said that that they could make a choice based on policy considerations. The Supreme Court justices have basically said there is a clear case for risk, and that the EPA is required essentially to take a fresh look.
Can you talk about who voted which way? The 5-4 decision, the significance of Roberts joining with Alito and Thomas and Scalia in voting against or for the Bush administration.
The significance essentially is that there is still a big chunk of. So there are people who are aligned with industry. There are people who just purely don't believe that a gas like carbon dioxide, the bubbles in beer, can actually be in the same basket with things like sulfur dioxide or mercury. And I'm not sure there's a pure ideological divide on the court on this. I do think that the science is not easy. And even during the arguments, Scalia said. There was at one point, it was an amazing moment during the arguments over this. Scalia, there was some confusion about the troposphere versus the stratosphere, and Scalia said something like, "Troposphere, stratosphere. That's why I don't want to have to deal with this global warming problem. It's complicated." And I do feel that in this country, there's still a big block of people. I got huge amounts of email. When these stories have run the last couple of days of mine on adapting to warming, from people who just don't even get the basics, that carbon dioxide makes the world warmer than it would otherwise be. If you have more of it in the atmosphere, that makes the world warmer. On that point, and the Supreme Court obviously now has echoed this, there is simply no knowledgeable disagreement in the scientific community. Even Michael Crichton at a recent debate in New York City, the author of State of Fear, you know, which says that all environmentalists are fearmongers. He and Richard Lindzen, another scientist at MIT who has attacked alarmist portrayals of the climate problem, they both agreed that carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. You put more of it in the air, it warms the world. And then it all comes down to judgments about how dangerous that is and what do you do about it.
We're talking to Andrew Refkin, award-winning science reporter with the New York Times. Now, explain, though, exactly what this means, for example, for California.
Well, California is trying to restrict vehicle emissions of carbon dioxide, and they claim they have the authority to do so. And this case actually relates to that one, in that now California will probably have an easier time moving ahead on its own efforts to do that locally. One thing that was really telling, I thought, in reading the USA Today this morning, their story on this case, the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, the main lobbying group in Washington for the auto companies, which had been stridently, you know, fighting the idea that CO2 was a regulatable gas. Now they've immediately switched to, we need an economy-wide standard for limiting it. They're basically, you see this, or I've seen this in 20 years of writing about climate change, this kind of stepwise defense. It's just like an army defending in a retreat. You kind of hold your ground, then move back to the next safe defense. And you can see that dynamic playing out here.
What about the role of the auto industry in all of this and the whole issue of how federal scientists' research has been suppressed, as we saw recently in a congressional hearing?
Well, for years, I've been exposing in a series of stories in the Times specific instances where people who had worked for the oil companies or people who were, you know, political appointees who had worked in the Bush reelection campaign were expressly trying to restrain scientists who felt that global warming was a problem and that carbon dioxide is a hazard from speaking their views. And this came to the fore just this a few weeks ago in a couple of congressional hearings. And there, too, you see this, there has been some change. The NASA, one of the agencies where that had happened, has changed their policies. NOAA came out with some new policies that scientists still aren't very happy with. That's the agency that studies the climate directly. But scientists that I talk to now feel much freer to speak their minds and not necessarily have a minder on the telephone anymore, as was the norm at NOAA for a long time. So I do get a sense of the ball rolling here in a way that in 20 years on this covering this issue I haven't seen.
Andrew Revkin, we have to break for a minute. We're going to come back to this discussion. And then we'll be talking about what's happening in Somalia, in Iraq, and in Africa as a whole. We'll be speaking with the former UN spokesperson in Iraq, Salim Loam, who now lives in Kenya. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back with the New York Times science reporter in a minute.
Down to the station now. You know, I leaned up against the door. I went down to the station, Lord. You know, I leaned up against the door. You know, I know that Empire State. Every time I hear that whistle blow, I ask the depot agent.
Empire State Blues by Uncle Wade, a band, well, our guest is a member of, Andrew Revkin, the award-winning science reporter at the New York Times. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Andrew, you've been doing in the last few days a series of pieces on the global divide between rich and poor nations. Can you talk about what you found?
Basically, there's several kinds of divides. Most of the wealthy nations of the world built a lot of their wealth on the industrialization that took place largely on the backs of fossil fuels, coal and oil. What happened is the carbon dioxide, the main greenhouse gas released by burning those fuels, accumulates in the air. It builds up and builds. It doesn't just go away when you turn off the engine. So there's a historical contribution from countries like the United States and the countries of Europe and the former Soviet Union that is the vast majority of the gas. There's been a lot of discussion recently about China. You know, its economy is in super high gear now, and any day now, it's probably going to surpass the U.S. in annual emissions. But China is a very small fraction of that accumulated human influence on the climate. So what we did was we looked around at countries that are prosperous and at countries that are not. The pieces that are in today, nytimes.com/earth, we went to four different countries, two poor, two rich, and found that the rich are all very happily adapting to climate extremes right now. We do things that money affords. Down in Perth, Australia, they've just built a huge plant that turns salt water into drinking water, and it's powered by a wind farm. And if that isn't a sign of the potential for a wealthy country to essentially deal with the hard knocks of climate change by just turning wind into water, essentially, that I don't know what does. And then two reporters went to Malawi, one of the poorest countries on the planet, and to a part of India that's chronically flooded by heavy downpours. And there we could see that the lack of resources gives you this huge constant vulnerability even now to the impacts that come with heavy climate extremes, big storms, rising seas, and drought. And essentially, so the countries that have created or are propelling this us toward a warmer world with more extremes of these kinds are already insulating themselves, even though they, under a treaty back in 1992, signed by the first President Bush, the rich countries of the world committed to helping the poor countries adapt to climate change. It just isn't happening.
In a place like Malawi, what actually takes place?
Well, agriculture is mostly fed by rain. That's true in the in the Corn Belt of the United States too, but it's very fluky. You'll have a year of floods and then a year of drought, and on and on. There's very little ability to store water. Groundwater there in the place where our correspondent Sharon Lafreniere went was contaminated by the recent flood. So it's kind of always a scrabble, and these rural farmers can barely get by as it is. So when you push things a little farther, and by the way, all the climate models, one of the places they're most confident on there being some pretty harsh changes is southern Africa, that whole sub-Sahelian part of Africa down through the peninsula, down to the very tip, is going to dry, particularly in the sort of June, July, August. And it's that is an area that really can't afford that right now. There's even some discussions by some scientists that we quoted that, you know, in countries like that, essentially the idea that they'll ever be self-sufficient in agriculture has to kind of go away. They have to, what has to happen there is some efforts to assist them in urban development, get people off the land so that they have the income from other kinds of enterprises that can allow them to purchase food from wetter places. Oh, by the other element in this climate divide is that moisture, precipitation is moving toward the poles, away from the equator. You look at a map of economics, you know that all the richest countries in the world are more mid-latitude and up, and all the poorest countries of the world, Australia being kind of closer to the equator than most, are generally in different places.
Andrew Revkin, you write, China may be a powerhouse now, but it's contributed less than 8% of the total emissions of carbon dioxide from energy use since 1850, while the U.S. is responsible for 29%, Western Europe 27%.
Yeah, that's it. You know, it's again, it's this cumulative. It comes down to an ethical question of what are we obligated to do to assist countries that will be most impacted by the changes that are forecast in a warming world, based on our historic contribution to that setup. Obviously, we didn't know for 150 years that these gases released by burning coal and oil were going to do this. We have known that with increasing confidence. For at least a couple of decades, three decades really, and now the picture is pretty crystal clear that again, especially in the long run, and the reason I wrote The North Pole was here, my new climate book for the next generation, is this is a long haul enterprise here. The in the long picture, we're talking about places on Earth that will be really profoundly transformed. Coasts will be retreating. In the Arctic, which we spent a lot of time reporting on a couple of years ago, there'll be profound change. And in some of the drier places on the world, they'll be getting drier. There will be benefits, for sure. There'll be places that are going to get wetter, including the upper tier in North America, where, and also growing seasons will be getting longer, which obviously will benefit farmers, at least for decades. And so that's another part of this inequity. You know, it gets to be very interesting when you look at the planet now. Look at who created the historical this problem that exists now, regardless of future trajectories for emissions, like in China. You get a pretty complicated picture.
Andrew Refkin, I was listening to Joe Barton, former head of the House Energy Committee, still a powerhouse on that issue, talking about how global warming is good for us. For example, it'll mean longer growing seasons in places like Russia. I wanted to ask about the critics like Barton and Inhofe. I know Inhofe attacked your book, The North Pole Was Here, on the floor of Congress, saying the author of the book, New York Times reporter Andrew Refkin, wrote that it may someday be easier to sail than to stand in the North Pole in summer. So here we have a very prominent environmental reporter for the New York Times who's promoting aspects of global warming alarmism in a book aimed at children.
Pretty wild stuff. Frankly, all the modeling shows late in the century the prospect of an open water Arctic Ocean in summertime. And that literally means, having stood at the North Pole on ice that's cracking and shifting and always kind of tentative, it will clearly be easier to sail than to stand on the North Pole later in the century. And I did have that word may, which, you know, this is a book that was just lauded by the National Science Teachers Association and Children's Book Council as the best, one of the best science books of 2006. And I'll take their view over the senator's view anytime.
Well, you have that senator, but then you have the former senator and former presidential candidate, Al Gore, and his film. Can you talk about the effect of An Inconvenient Truth on the political debate in this country?
Sure. I've written about it, the film, a few times, and about this effort by Al Gore and others to really, you know, get under people's skin and propel them and, to some extent, scare them into action. Frankly, in some stories that I've done, I talk to a lot of people who question that tactic as being the thing that will do the magic trick of making a country change its habits related to fossil fuels and look with a longer term at how we weigh risks. There's some danger in trying to portray this huge, slowly developing planetary scale problem as a planetary emergency that people will tune out if nature, in all of its wonderful variability, sort of throws a few cold years at us, which is entirely possible. In fact, it's impossible for that not to happen. Nature doesn't work in smooth ways. And there's still a lot of things about global warming that we don't know clearly. We do know the basics. As I said earlier, even Michael Crichton and Richard Lindzen of MIT agree on the basic idea that more greenhouse gases make the world warmer. But when you get into things that were very featured in the film, like hurricane intensity or how quickly the Arctic will go ice-free, those are more complicated scientific questions, and they're not a slam dunk. And so I, in The North Pole Was Here, and in my writing, I've tried to emphasize the middle, meaning the science that no one disagrees on presents a pretty powerful picture already of a world in transition from being a place that was not influenced by people on a global scale to one in which we now have our hand on the thermostat of a planet. And it's a one-way thermostat because of that long-lived nature of these greenhouse gases. So you can't kind of suddenly say, oh, geez, we turned the heat up too high, we have to turn it down. It won't work that way. And so that there is a legitimate question, I think, that many experts have raised about this idea of trying to portray this as an old-style catastrophe in the making, because it is more nuanced than that.
Andrew Refkin, by the way, was the first New York Times reporter ever to file stories and photographs from the floating sea ice at the top of the world. Andrew, I want to ask about the tsunami and the Solomon Islands. Is that related at all to global warming?
Not to global warming at all, although it is related to, again, the harsh reality is poor people are more vulnerable to extremes, coastal or climatic, than rich people. New Orleans showed that we have our own vulnerabilities as well, but as you know, in writing a lot about that disaster, we certainly can't blame a lack of knowledge. We can blame a lack of investment in levees and things that, again, but at least we have the capacity to build levees when we need them. In places like the Solomon Islands, or in a lot of those coastlines along the Indian Ocean where they were swept in the terrible tsunami of 2004 that I spent a lot of time writing about too, There's no infrastructure. As we wrote in today's piece on climate adaptation, in India, where Somini Sengupta went for us for today's story, their idea of an alarm system for a flash flood is an official running around with a megaphone. And that's essentially the same. We already have these buoys now in the world's oceans to alert us when a tsunami is coming to the East Coast or parts of Asia. But how do you get that information to a Solomon Islander? You don't. So there's an imbalance in our vulnerability to what nature can throw at humans. And that's going to be there for a long time until economic prosperity lifts developing countries more into being more developed.
I wanted to end with New Orleans. You say we have the capacity to build levees, but have the levees been built?
No. New Orleans is still an underprotected city. It's a city, you know, when you have a city that's below sea level and in a zone where we know Category 5 hurricanes prowl, whether or not climate change will intensify storms, you have a profound kind of you're rolling the dice every year. And New Orleans, the investments in the levees there were always underinvested on the side that required local money. The Mississippi side of New Orleans, Mississippi Riverside, was girded like to a gold standard because it was part of this big 17-state defense for flooding. But they left the back door open, and that's where Katrina hit. The problem in a city like New Orleans really is that, as one sociologist and historian told me for a story I did, it's a city that's impossible and inevitable, that nature makes it almost impossible, but its circumstances, its geography makes it almost inevitable. And when we have a situation like that, given the wealth in this country and the scientific expertise, for it to remain vulnerable, either people have to move out of areas that really can't be protected affordably, or a lot more has to be spent on girding a place like that has those characteristics.
Andrew Revkin, I want to thank you for being with us. Award-winning science reporter for the New York Times. His latest book is The North Pole Was Here, Puzzles and Perils at the Top of the World. His earlier book, The Burning Season, The Murder of Chico Mendez and the Fight for the Amazon Rainforest. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. And our headlines are also in Spanish, in audio and transcript form for any radio station take around the world. Over 100 are taking those headlines. As we turn now to Africa, nearly 400 civilians have been killed and 550 wounded in fighting between insurgents and Ethiopian-backed troops in the Somali capital of Mogadishu just since Thursday, this according to a local human rights group. The toll from the Elman Peace and Human Rights Organization was the first comprehensive count of casualties from what aid agencies are calling the worst fighting in Somalia in 15 years. Nearly 50,000 people have fled Mogadishu in the last 10 days, according to the UN Refugee Agency. A total of 96,000 people left their homes during February and March. Ethiopian tanks, artillery, and helicopter gunships have fought against guerrillas armed with machine guns, missiles, and rocket-propelled grenades. The guerrilla forces comprise fighters allied to the Somali Council of Islamic Courts and clan militias who are opposed to the transitional government and the Ethiopian occupation. A lull in fighting on Monday gave residents a chance to pull several hundred bodies from the streets. Local hospitals have been overwhelmed with casualties. This is the director of the Medina Hospital, Dr. Sheikhton Salad Elmi.
The hospital staff, many of them could not reach the hospital because of the fighting. The number of casualties we received is a small percentage compared to the real casualties in the field.
A small African Union peacekeeping force in Somalia of some 1,200 Ugandan soldiers has failed to stem the violence. While the 4 days of fierce fighting subsided after a truce was negotiated Sunday, hundreds more Ethiopian troops have been seen arriving in Mogadishu over the weekend. Salim Lone is a columnist for the Daily Nation in Kenya and a former spokesperson for the UN mission in Iraq. We're going to go to break. When we come back, we'll talk about what's happening in Somalia, also in Iraq. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Back in a minute.
Once more, last night in my vision, people tired of the situation got on the street to change our position, saying the world needs something to carry on, saying the world need to be just one nation. I hear the voice of Natasha crying on the street of Guatemala. At the same time in South Africa, people dying in Nigeria, for freedom, for food, they struggle in Somalia. For freedom, for food, they're starving in Africa. Revolution, she's knocking on our door. In silence, she will knock some more. Revolution, won't scare them away. The people are the big army, I say. Revolution.
Revolution. Revolution. Revolution by Luko Ajafi. From his CD, Passion. We'll link to his website at oursdemocracynow.org. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest is Salim Lone, columnist for the Daily Nation in Kenya, former spokesperson for the UN mission in Iraq, joining us in our Firehouse studio for the few days he's in New York, then returning to Kenya. It's great to have you with us.
Great to be here, Abby. Thank you so much.
Talk about what's happening in Somalia today.
You know, you described the terrible scenes that are going on in Mogadishu. I just want to add that this is not only a terrible war, but also the most lawless war. It violates clearly the invasion by Ethiopia, the UN Charter, the support of the US, and the attacks by the US violate the UN Charter. But in addition, there are two explicit UN resolutions by the Security Council that this violates. The UN Security Council resolution in December said there should be no troops from regional neighboring countries going into Somalia as part of a peacekeeping force. And yet we have Ethiopian troops there, not as part of a peacekeeping force. It's also turned the whole region into a giant Guantanamo Bay. Human Rights Watch reported that over 100 people were kidnapped in Kenya. Kenya, the most stable and a very law-abiding country in Africa, was forced to kidnap suspected supporters of the ICU, the Islamic courts, and to hand them over to Somalia, which in turn handed most of them over to Ethiopia, where they have disappeared. So this is really a terrible war, and another reason it's so terrible is because for 6 months last year, from June to December, as reported by Democracy Now!, as reported by the New York Times, BBC, Deutsche Welle, Xinhua News Agency, every media in the world reported that the Islamic Courts Union had brought a high level of stability to Somalia, and they had done so without the massive use of force. So this is just, you know, a classic example of the U.S. overreaching, relentless drive for domination rather than caring for the stability and security of small nations.
What is the U.S.'s interest here?
Oh, it's also very clear. First of all, this is a crucial region. It's the Horn of Africa. Somalia is at the heart of the Horn of Africa. You have the Red Sea, through which, you know, tankers and military armadas flow every day. It's also a newly oil-rich region. We've had the Somali president in that region twice in a year, trying to negotiate deals. So the U.S. what they wanted in Somalia was what they wanted in Iraq. I mean, the similarities are quite astonishing. It's just that the world knows about Iraq. The media here does not cover Somalia at all, except as spot news. the U.S. began to say, once the Islamic Courts Union became dominant in Somalia last year, it began to say there is terrorism there, just like it said about Saddam Hussein, that he was linked to terrorists. It also began in Iraq, we had the weapons of mass destruction. Well, we have a weapon of mass destruction, according to the U.S., in Somalia, which is Muslims. Islamists are just routinely now conflated with extremists. So it gives the U.S., I shouldn't say the U.S., because I'm hoping that there will be a change in the U.S., and it will actually, a new Democratic majority and the new president will do something about it. It has given the Bush administration the camouflage to impose its own client regime in Somalia, which will do its bidding. And the same for Ethiopia. Neither one of them actually cares for stability and security in Somalia. If they did, they would have engaged with the Islamic Courts Union. The Islamic Courts Union made repeated efforts to say to the West, we want to negotiate. Yes, they had a few hotheads in there. They had some people who might even have been terrorists. But this was vastly exaggerated so that the U.S. could pursue its goals.
Who are the Islamic Courts Union?
You know, it's very interesting. Despite the name, they were actually started by Somali businessmen. Somalis are great entrepreneurs. And even in the 15 years of violence, they have the best cell phone system. They've done amazing things in the chaos, Somali businessmen. But they wanted a more secure environment for themselves. So, knowing that the Somali people are very Muslim, Somalis are amongst the world's most abiding Muslims, but they are not at all extremists. They're very moderate Muslims. You know, in Canada, a few years ago, there was an attempt by Muslims to have Sharia imposed in some limited civil cases. And you know who organized that? It wasn't Saudis. It wasn't Pakistanis. It was actually Somalis in Canada because they believe in Sharia law. So these businessmen decided that if they could use Sharia law as a uniting factor in Somalia, there would be peace there and they could do better. So 11 courts were established. 9 of them were led by very moderate Somalis. 2 of them were led by radicals. So that is what the Islamic Courts Union was, and they quickly provided security and they quickly began to provide services. And that is why they became so popular. And that is why the U.S. and Ethiopia decided to go and overthrow them.
The U.S. Special Operations Forces launched 2 attacks, a pair of airstrikes on Somalia in January. Explain what happened there.
Well, again, the reason given was that they were attacking terrorists on the run. You know, in Kenya, we had this terrible demolition, really, of the U.S. embassy there by terrorists in 1998. Over 210 people died, most of them Kenyans. So those terrorists...
The twin embassy attacks in Tanzania and in Kenya.
And in Kenya, right. But the Tanzanian was a small attack. Only about 7 people died, but more than 200 died. It was a devastating attack in Kenya. And thousands very badly maimed and injured. Attack was planned in Somalia, in lawless Somalia. Somalia has been lawless for 15 years. But there were no Somalis involved in that attack. People forget that. People just think of Somalia. That's where it was planned. But there were no Somalis involved in that attack. Now, because of that fear of those terrorists, which is a legitimate fear, and we expect the United States to act against terrorists in a lawful way, though, not the way they're doing, they had not carried out any attacks for the last 15 years in Somalia, or even since 1998. If it's a terrorist they were going to, was it the first time they were able to identify the terrorists there? No. They were going after the leadership of the Islamic Courts Union. We must not forget that. As it turns out, we know now that there was no terrorist leader killed in that attack. It was Islamic Courts Union's killed. But, you know, that was not the only lawless act by the United States. The United States, actually, from the very beginning, has worked very closely with Ethiopia, with its special forces, in organizing the invasion. John Abizaid, the chief of CENTCOM, was there in Ethiopia in December. The U.S. Rangers are very active in Kenya, carrying out, by the way, development projects, which is scary because this is how you make humanitarian organizations targets, because you identify them with military activities.
We're talking to Salim Lone, former spokesman for the UN mission in Iraq, yes, when it also was blown up with the head of the mission, among others, Sergio de Mello, dying in that attack. He's now retired. He's a columnist in Kenya for the Daily Nation. I wanted to go to Sudan for a moment. The African Union has called on Sudan to speed up plans for a new AU, African Union, UN peace force in Darfur, where five Senegalese soldiers were killed Sunday. They were part of the AU force. Explain what's happening there.
You know, Sudan is an enormously complex situation. In fact, outside of Somalia, Sudan is the most unstable state in the region. People don't know that. It has, after many, like a decade and a half, of the most vicious civil war between North and South that people know about, come to a peace agreement there. But that also is in the process of unraveling, and it has not been, it's not being talked about anywhere. The Darfur crisis is, of course, what gets all the attention. And rightly so. I mean, it's a terrible situation, and the world must put maximum pressure on the regime of Bashir to do something about it, to stop the killing.
How come it hasn't worked?
It hasn't worked for a number of reasons. First of all, right from the start, around 2005, when this crisis blew up, you know, the crisis is an old one. It began actually in Chad. You know, we talk of neighboring countries, separate countries, but they're all the same people. Darfurians and Chadians on the border, they're all the same. They're all Darfurians. So Janjaweed is about 20 years old, but we only heard about it now. Big struggle for resources between the pastoralists, the sedentarists. So this struggle is age-old, but it became very intense in 2004. And immediately in 2005, there were calls for the use of force against Sudan. The Economist, I remember, wrote a big editorial telling Tony Blair, you must intervene. And it asked a question in a headline, would it be lawful to intervene in Sudan? And the answer it gave right away was, we don't care if it's lawful. It must be done. You know, recently, Susan Smith and Tony Lake proposed that the Darfur be bombed, the Sudan be bombed. So what you have now, therefore, is a regime which is convinced that the real aim of the West is regime change, as in Sudan, as now we've seen in Somalia. The only way to address the crisis is working politically with the Sudanese regime, despite the terrible things it's doing. And it must feel assured that the only aim of the international community, including the United Nations, you know, there is deep suspicion in the Muslim world about the United Nations, because we saw in Iraq that all the information that the UN gathered was actually used by the United States in the war. So the UN now is commonly seen as a front for the United States. So we must assure that regime that our aim is only to bring about peace in Darfur, not regime change. And yet there are calls all the time for attacking Sudan.
Salim Lone, your last piece in the Daily Nation of Kenya is called The Last Thing We Need, and you're talking about U.S. AFRICOM. Explain what it is.
You know, it is actually the last thing the UN, that Africa needs. This is a U.S. military command all its own for Africa. And this is not what Africa needs. This is the most impoverished continent in the world. It's been asking for decades for engagement, long-term engagement, commitment from the West for mutually beneficial economic progress. And suddenly, President Bush announces in February, we are going to have a U.S. command. And you know how he projected it? He said, this command is going to help Africa develop. It is bizarre. I mean, what this command is going to do is going to militarize Africa. It is going to inflame conflicts. There is so much anger against the United States, especially if it's in the Horn of Africa region, which is primarily Muslim. If it is there, there will be new anger. You know, establishing bases seems to have become like a routine thing to do now. People used to be horrified by the notion of independent nations being made to accept bases. Bases are just the terrible things for countries. And yet, this is the way the president is proceeding. And he's saying that he's doing it to crush terrorism, which would be fine. But here again, you see the conviction. The reflexive, you know, resort to the use of force to grapple with deeply political issues. There's a conviction in the Bush administration that if you can pour in enough troops somewhere, if you can kill enough suspected terrorists, you will deal with deeply political problems, that you will solve them. This is not the case.
Do you think what the U.S. is doing has anything to do with China's expanding presence in Africa?
Oh, without any question. I mean, I'm glad you raised the issue of China, because China, as I said earlier, is interested in the same oil and other resources that Africa offers. But how differently it is pursuing it. It is going there and making bilateral agreements, giving aid, etc. And in fact, India is also quite interested in Africa. It's not so much talked about. But this is actually a very wonderful development. Potentially, the rise of China within Africa and India as sort of antagonists, so to speak, to the U.S., could create a bipolarity. And one of the great problems we have in the world today is that it's a unipolar world. There's only one superpower. And the gross crimes that the U.S. has committed, most of them in recent history, have come since the collapse of the Soviet Union, because the U.S. feels free to do as it wishes. So if we can, in our region, have China and India as competing powers, there is some hope that it will help the U.S., push the U.S. towards moderation. But one of the great problems here is that so little is known about Somalia and the region. We have a situation where Barack Obama is on the same page with George Bush on the question of Somalia. He's a co-sponsor of an amendment at the moment on Somalia, which is, you know, designed to root out terrorism, et cetera, et cetera. We need to reach out
Barack
to...
Barack Obama, whose father comes from Kenya.
Even though his father comes from Kenya, he does not know enough about what the U.S. is actually doing, because he co-signed, he's one of the co-sponsors. So we need to reach out to people like Barack Obama and the many other senators and congresspeople who care. But they don't know. And I'm so glad that you do as much as you do on Somalia and that region, because we need to inform them so that they can take action and change policy.
Salim Lohn, you survived the attack on the U.N. compound when many of your colleagues did not. What happened that day? Why were you not in the building?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Two things. First, I will say that very morning, I had organized a meeting of all the communication officers to discuss the falling image of the UN in Iraq. And we were really worried that very morning that we could be attacked. But in terms of the specific question, I was going to be part of that meeting in the afternoon at 4 o'clock, where Arthur Helton, and a colleague, very interested in the civilian toll the Iraq war was taking, even at that time, had come to see Sergio. And Sergio asked me just before the meeting to please go and write a statement about the killing outside Abu Ghraib prison of Mazen Dana, a Reuters cameraman. And, you know, that saved my life. It didn't save anyone else's, but...
Well, I want to thank you very much, Salim Lohn. I wish we had more time to talk. But for now, Salim Lohn, former spokesman for the UN mission in Iraq, now a columnist for the Daily Nation in Kenya, in New York, for this few days. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Amy.
Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkadous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Aaron Maté, Jen Utes, Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, Miguel Noguera, engineer. Special thanks to Angel Alston, Andrew Quinn, Becca Staley, Hugh Grant, John Randolph, Kieran Krug-Meadows, Jerome Bourgeois, Tori Townsend, Nicole Salazar, Samantha Chambly. On April 16th, they'll be at Faneuil Hall in Boston with Howard Zinn on Patriots Day. You can go to our website for more details at democracynow.org. There you can also get our transcript and our video and audio podcasting. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.